Hello and welcome to On Air with Myrick O'Connell. I'm Howard Kaplan. This On Air podcast features attorneys from Myrick O'Connell, a full-service law firm with offices in Worcester, Westboro, and Boston. Today's guest is attorney Jim Donnelly. Jim is a member of Myrick O'Connell's litigation department, whose practice focuses on civil litigation and business disputes. We should note that we're recording this episode in the midst of the coronavirus or COVID-19 crisis. Today we'll discuss the challenging situation many nonprofit volunteer boards of directors find themselves in due to this crisis. Jim Donnelly, we want to thank you so much for joining me on air with Myrick O'Connell.
Well, thanks, Howard. It's a privilege and a pleasure, and I might just supplement the introduction you gave by saying that a lot of what I say is not just as a lawyer, but having spent a lot of time in the trenches, because I am an officer and a board member of several pretty substantial nonprofits. So this is sort of an adjunct to my litigation practice, but the legal principles are very important. And I also do, as a lawyer, represent a lot of nonprofits, although my board time and officer time is always volunteered.
Sure. No, thank you for that additional information. And I've known you, of course, for years, and that is indeed true. I can verify that. Most nonprofit organizations are governed, as you know, by volunteer trustees who are recruited from the community and agree to serve without compensation because they identify with the mission and look forward to the satisfaction of doing good, unquote, for the community. A majority have no training or experience in corporate governance, and almost by definition, they have no economic stake in the organization. In good times, it's a wonderful experience, I think we'd all agree. But what happens in hard times, such as the one we're facing with COVID-19, when the organization is struggling financially? Or worse yet, when the board needs to take disciplinary action against senior staff, or consider a merger that may perpetuate elements of the mission, but otherwise terminate the organization. What's the best way for board members to cope with difficult decisions? Jim Donnelly will help us sort out right now all these complex issues during this podcast in just 25 minutes. Jim.
Okay. Let's get on with it.
That's right. Yeah, so let's go. So, Jim, the first question would be, what are the typical sources of conflict?
Well, I think it's important to, first of all, recognize two different kinds of conflict, and I'll talk about each of them separately. The first conflict, which is the one with the biggest legal consequence, are conflicts of interest, where a board member has a business relationship with the organization and is essentially sitting on both sides of the transaction. But the day-to-day conflict that is really much more common comes in the dilemmas that you face in trying to bring the organization forward. What are the trade-offs between the mission and the finances? It's very important, for example, if you're a food pantry, to be providing food to as many people as possible, but you have to be able to afford it, and you have to be able to afford the salaries and so forth. So there's a conflict always in that the organization is financially responsible. And then another very frequent issue is that you naturally develop good, loyal relationships with staff members, but you have to step back and sometimes make tough decisions, sometimes about whether they're doing an adequate job, sometimes about their salary, sometimes about whether the organization has to lay people off. The challenge, I'd say the most common challenge, particularly where the board member doesn't have an economic stake, is maintaining financial discipline. It's easy to just keep spending money until it's all gone, and that's one of the big temptations and dangers that has to be reckoned with. And then I guess the last one, which I don't want to neglect to mention, is that there's sometimes a who's in charge problem. Typically, a nonprofit will have a CEO whose title might be executive director, and the board and the CEO have to work together. But which issues fall into whose camp? And that can be a frequent source of conflict.
How should board members prioritize all these different mandates and priorities and duties?
Well, to begin with, it's worth pointing out that a board member has basically three duties, and they are duties to the organization, not to the CEO, not to people who work there. It's to the organization.
Mm-hmm.
You have to simply put the interests of the organization first, and you have to another dilemma that sometimes comes up is people get very, very dedicated to an organization and lose sight of its mission.
Yes.
Organization almost becomes like a social club.
Yep.
But you still have to carry out the mission. So I would say the most important thing is to look at what the mission is and keep reminding yourself of it. And I might add, to stop from time to time and make sure that everybody understands the mission and from time to time refresh and clarify the mission.
Good advice, and particularly during this challenging period of time here. Here's a question I think a lot of people listening and who deal with nonprofits and really any organization that has a board would have. Who supervises board decisions?
Well, in Massachusetts, and I might say nonprofit organizations are generally formed under a special statute, which is called Chapter 180. Nonprofits are generally supervised by the Attorney General of Massachusetts, and there's a division in that office that will, that enforces compliance with nonprofit law. To some degree, of course, the Internal Revenue Service will, to make sure that the organization is actually functioning consistently with its charitable mission. But principally, it's the Attorney General.
Now, are board members subject to lawsuits? That's another popular question. Not so much popular because it's fun, but because people are scared. And if so, who can bring them and on what grounds?
Well, first of all, the technically accurate answer, but not a complete answer. So I'll expand on it later. But the technically accurate answer is the only person who has what we lawyers call standing to sue nonprofit board members for things that they do in the capacity of a board member is the Attorney General of Massachusetts, or potentially the Internal Revenue Service. There's much less exposure than, say, the director of a private for-profit company.
Mm-hmm.
But the unpleasant truth that all lawyers know is that all it takes to file a lawsuit is to file a complaint in the applicable court and pay the filing fee of a few hundred dollars. And so even though a community member, for example, does not have standing, and that type of a lawsuit will typically be, will almost inevitably be dismissed, there's still a lawsuit and somebody has to appear and defend it and explain to the judge why it would need to be dismissed. I'll come in a minute to how you protect yourself against that eventuality. In any case, even with the Attorney General, The only basis for liability for an action taken as a board member, say voting on a resolution or something like that, is if the action is taken, it's really for a selfish advantage at the expense of the organization. In other words, if you are taking charitable assets from the organization and putting them in your own pocket, and if that's in bad faith. So there's the likelihood of liability is very small, and the only person that has standing to make that type of claim is the Attorney General. But every trustee should take some steps that we can talk about in a sec to protect themselves from the inconvenience and the expense of a lawsuit, even if it's a baseless one.
And what are those steps, Jim?
So the first one is, there are two different aspects of this. First of all, you want to stick with best practices. So I'll talk for a second about best practices and some legal protections. So the first thing is to always openly disclose to the other people in the organization any conflict of interest that you might have. And in fact, if every organization ought to, at least once a year, poll every board member to disclose any business relationship that they or a member of their family might have with the organization. The business relationship might be okay if it is a genuine arm's length transaction, but it has to. The important thing is to disclose it so that it doesn't look like it's been kept secret. And then the second thing is that when the board acts on, say, a contract that a family member might have with it, it might just be a snowplowing contract or any kind of a contract.
Sure.
You want to step out of the room when the other board members discuss that and vote on it so that you're not actually participating in the vote. And also you want to, every charitable organization has to make certain filings both with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and with the Internal Revenue Service. So you should ask the treasurer, both the board treasurer and the organizational financial person, to make sure that all of the filings are made correctly. And ideally, you should have every organization ought to have a good CPA who will every year come in and just provide that extra level of assurance. And the final thing, by the way, it sounds easy, but sometimes it isn't. Board members should always be asking questions.
Yeah.
You know, we're all a little bit shy. We all don't want to be nosy. We don't want to be seen as pushy. We want to get along with the people in the room. But one of the most important duties of a board member is to ask questions that are meaningful and probing. So you always have to remember that that's part of the responsibility.
What are the limits on exposure for these boards if they should be sued or if some other action is taken against them?
The first and foremost is that Chapter 180 has a provision that board members who are serving as volunteers, that is unpaid board members, can only be liable for actions that are taken in bad faith for selfish purposes, to put money in your own pocket or in the pocket of a family member. So that's a pretty good foundation. But you shouldn't stop there. Among the questions that you should ask if you're a trustee is whether or not the organization's articles and bylaws have contained provisions that mirror that statutory immunity. So it should exist both places.
Right.
And the bylaws should provide for indemnification, too. In other words, let's just suppose that somebody does bring a suit, even a baseless one. The bylaws should say that the organization has an obligation to defend you so that you don't have to take money out of your own pocket for it.
Right.
And then a very important one is to get directors and officers insurance, or D&O insurance, as we talk about it. And the reason for that is, no matter how wealthy the organization is, the insurance policy will defend you. It's sometimes referred to, and even the state Supreme Court has referred to insurance as litigation insurance, because they have to provide a lawyer to take care of you, and they have to pay for it. So it's those three things. First of all, there's a statute that's on the books. You don't have to worry, do anything about that other than take advantage of it.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, make sure the bylaws conform to the statute. And third, be sure that the organization has D&O insurance.
This is very, very helpful information, particularly right now where boards are faced with some very challenging financial and non-financial dilemmas. Speaking of that, what are the best practices for board members faced with very difficult decisions, Jim?
Well, some of them are things I've touched on earlier. It's important to always be open and transparent, particularly if there's any remotest possibility of a conflict of interest.
Sure.
And to ask questions and educate yourself about the facts of any issue, particularly if it's a financial issue. Questions are probably asking good questions is probably one of the most important responsibilities of a board member. And you want to make sure that whoever is chairing the meeting allows plenty of time for discussion. And sometimes there'll be a decision that is so contentious that it might even be appropriate to bring in a professional moderator, a consultant who can guide the board through the process.
Mm.
Because frankly, people who are extremely sincere and good people can still have strong disagreements about the right way to do something.
In fact, sometimes the disagreements can be the strongest, actually, when one is really passionate about a topic.
Yeah. And I would say, too, another element of best practices is to listen carefully to what the other people have to say. You know, we're all human.
Right.
We all like it better when people tell us things that we already believe. But sometimes, and trust me, I have experienced this a lot, sometimes listening to somebody that you disagree with ultimately produces a much better decision than just trying to force your own preconceived view. And then finally, you want to make sure when you do make a difficult or a controversial decision, which in an extreme case could be a decision to close the organization, you want to have a principled reason for having made that decision. You want to be able to look the world in the eye. You want to be able to talk to a newspaper reporter and say, this is why we did it. And it was painful, but it was the right thing to do.
Can you give us some examples of that? Because I know you do have them in your vast experience.
Well, one is one of the ones that I think is most interesting is a vicarious one. I wasn't personally involved in it, but it was really quite controversial, and the trustees were in quite a hot seat. Which did include, by the way, litigation. And that was a museum in Pittsfield called the Berkshire Museum, which had some wonderful art pieces, particularly some original Norman Rockwell paintings. And if I recall it accurately, Norman Rockwell had actually given some of them to the museum.
Yeah.
But the museum was struggling financially, and more to the point, Some of the trustees were concerned that Pittsfield had other needs that were more important than being an art museum, and they thought that it would be better if they sold some of these items, the Rockwell prints and paintings that were extremely valuable, and converted to a children's museum. Art lovers were utterly scandalized, and one of the descendants of Norman Rockwell sued the trustees and the museum because the trustees were basically changing the mission of the museum. Ultimately, a superior court judge, one of the best superior court judges, by the way, made a decision that what the trustees did was okay. Ultimately, the attorney general, the lawsuit by the Rockwell heir was dismissed precisely because only the attorney general could bring that type of a lawsuit. And the attorney general was finally persuaded that what the board did was responsible and accepted the judge's decision that the trustees were within their rights. But it was a very tough decision for everybody concerned, and it caused a lot of trouble.
It was indeed. I remember and refresh my memory by reading about it the other day as well. Now, you have an example that you were personally involved in.
Yes. Anybody from around Worcester, I hope, will have very fond memories of the John Woodman Higgins Armory Museum.
Yes.
It's up on Barber Avenue. And I, for many years, was a trustee there and eventually was the president of it. But we confronted back, it was probably about 2009 or thereabouts, sort of after the last financial crisis before the one we're facing right now, the trustees came to the conclusion that the museum just couldn't continue financially, that the resources weren't there. And it was very, very difficult because it was a beloved institution. And many of the people who loved it, including some of the trustees and including some of the corporators, which is a term that applies to people that are get to vote on things but are a little bit less involved, were not persuaded that every stone had been turned. Some of them wanted to try a fundraising campaign, and the board was sort of caught in the middle because the museum was basically burning assets at a rate of $450,000 a year.
Hmm.
And it had a limited amount to burn. And if it just, there was a great temptation to just keep conducting business as usual.
Sure.
But within 4 or 5 years, the money would have run out. And you know, you'd essentially be selling priceless objects in an insolvency situation, which would have been a nightmare. So the board eventually came up with the solution of essentially merging the Higgins Armor Museum into the Worcester Art Museum. And you know, just in the interest of full disclosure, I am now a trustee of the Worcester Art Museum, but I was not then. And ultimately, it was a great decision in several senses. Number one, it saved the collection.
Right.
Number two, it kept it in Worcester. Number three, it contributed a lot to the revitalization of the Worcester Art Museum, but it was very controversial, and some of the descendants of John Woodman Higgins were very upset that the museum didn't remain independent, and they wanted to try to raise enough money to keep it going. The trustees just had to make a wise decision that seemed the best that they could do at the time, and that is what we did, but there was a lot of press coverage, and some of it didn't feel pretty at the time.
Yes, I remember. Yep.
Yeah. As we look back on it, I think we felt that we played the hand that we were dealt.
Exactly.
The best way we could have played it.
Exactly.
And I think and I'm grateful that most of the people that thought it was the wrong thing at the time have come to come to accept that a lot has of good has come from it, and incidentally, the more good will come of it in the future, because the Worcester Art Museum is in the process of planning the Higgins Gallery. That has been a complicated process, but in the meantime, we've saved at least some of the jobs and some of the key people, and saved the collection, and it's made Worcester a better place.
That's a great way, actually, to wrap this session of On Air with Myrick O'Connell up on nonprofit boards and the tough decisions they are facing right now in light of the COVID-19 crisis, because it seems to embody most of the guidelines and thought processes that you've outlined for us today, I think.
Yeah. I mean, those certainly are two good illustrations. There are many others, too. And I will, you know, maybe just my own parting observation is that although I have always found being a board member to be very fulfilling, sometimes it is really hard work.
Yeah.
And sometimes you wake up in the middle of the night and can't go back to sleep because you're worrying about what's the right thing to do and will people feel hurt by it or disagree with it. It's just, ultimately, I encourage anybody who has the opportunity to serve as a trustee, it's a real privilege, but it's also real work.
Today's guest on Air with Myrick O'Connell has been attorney Jim Donnelly from the firm. Jim has been talking about requirements and processes and issues involved in nonprofit boards of directors specifically, and how it all relates to the current crisis, the decision processes that a board needs to make, that needs to keep in mind as it makes what may be tough decisions in this crisis. Jim, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Howard.
You can learn how Jim and his colleagues at Myrick O'Connell can assist you with your business and personal legal needs by visiting myrickoconnell.com. This podcast is brought to you by the law firm of Myrick O'Connell. It is intended to inform you of developments in the law and to provide information of general interest. It is not intended to constitute legal advice and should not be relied upon as such. This podcast may be considered advertising under the rules of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. I'm Howard Kaplan. On behalf of Myrick O'Connell and attorney Jim Donnelly, thanks for joining us. Take care and stay safe.